Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mintzer.
I want to welcome everybody to my fourth Tuesday Revolutionize Your Retirement interview with expert series. I'm Dorian Mintzer, owner of Revolutionize Retirement and your host for the show. And I'm so delighted, Vicki, to have you with us today. I met Vicki just before I give the introduction. I actually met Vicki a few years ago at a positive aging conference that was out in California. And Andrea, who's a friend of Vicki's and who also lives nearby her, had said, oh, you really need to come and hear her presentation on caregiving. So I went to the presentation and I was so impressed and learned so much. And Vicki has actually presented one other time. I can't remember if it was right around when the book came out or maybe after when your book had come out. Maybe it had been out, I guess, for a while. And she has another book, a resource workbook now. And so it seemed like an opportunity to have her back. So let me just tell you a little about Vicki. Vicki is a clinical bioethicist, a professional speaker, and a hospice volunteer. Her award-winning book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Making Choices for Those Who Can't, guides families and professionals who are making decisions for those who have lost capacity. She's known as the people's bioethicist because she's a rare individual who bridges two worlds, that of the healthcare professional and of the family struggling to make the right decision. She's an honorary board member of the Well Spouse Association and has been a caregiver for many years for six members of her family. So she has incredible professional and personal experiences. And her more recent book, it's The Caregiver's Path, a resource workbook, conversation guide, and visual toolkit. And it provides uniquely designed communication tools for managing challenging conversations, such as evaluating danger and risk, managing guilt and denial, end-of-life decisions, and helping the family know when it's time to create a new care plan. Vicki lectures across the United States, teaching professionals to have integrity, compassion, and to improve care through better communication and ethical frameworks. Many patients and families and professionals have really benefited from her practical approach to dealing with ethically challenging dilemmas, of which there are so many in this complicated world that we live in. So, Vicki, I am really delighted that you're back here. And just for those of you who might have come on late, I just want to encourage you on the internet site, the event page on the left-hand side, you can submit your own questions. And Vicki is going to donate a copy of her book to the best question as judged by me. I encourage you to say who you are, and I'll just say first names and ask questions. So Vicki, why don't we start with let me just add one other thing, that when Vicki and I were talking about the call, one of the things she said is that so often people talk to her about regrets and about mistakes they've made. And so she felt, and I totally agreed, that this call will be an opportunity that we can both learn from Vicki and learn from concerns and mistakes that people have made and questions that they have. And two questions have already been submitted. So Vicki, you can integrate them whenever you'd like to. So welcome. And perhaps you can start.
I'm so happy
Go ahead.
To be here, Dori.
You
were wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming back. So maybe we can start with what are some of the ethical questions that people ask you? And also you may toward the beginning want to respond to the questions that came to you. And if and when you do that, it'll be important to let people know what the question is so that,
sure,
you know, they know what you're responding to.
Sure. It's interesting. I speak at a lot of conferences, whether it's for professionals or caregivers. And after the event, I always get people that come up to me and they're about to break into tears. And they're like, Vicki, can I talk to you? And you can see how troubled they are. And usually the story goes, 10 years ago, I made this decision. Did I do the right thing? Sometimes people ask me about current situations, but usually it's about, what did I do something wrong? Should I still feel badly about it? Am I okay? Because as family caregivers, we are burdened, not just in our day-to-day, but we're burdened by the choices we make and the choices we have made. And like a common one that people ask me is, I buried my mom and I should have cremated her. I know she wanted to be cremated, but I didn't want to do that. I buried her instead, or the opposite. That is a really common one. And so one of the techniques I use with people is I go through the process and I find out, I tell them that when we've made mistakes, that we have to own up, we have to say we're sorry, and then we have to try to make it right. It is a basic ethical, good social behavior. And so if there's something we could do, if that we could fix it, like it's really hard to uncremate somebody. I know that sounds kind of morbid. We can't fix that, but the fact that they're talking about it, that they're seeing, did I do the right thing? I let them know that you can't fix this, but now that you know it was a mistake, you need to make sure you don't do that again. Because it's based on that idea of respect for people, honoring people's wishes. What would that person have wanted us to do? If that's possible, we're supposed to do that. We're not supposed to just change the plan because we want it different. If you're in that role where you're supposed to be the person implementing the plan, whether it's healthcare or after the death, if you're not comfortable implementing the plan because you don't like the plan, then someone else should be in charge. And if you're picking someone to be your decision maker and they say to you, oh, I would hate to have that happen, or I would hate to have to do that, then they're not the right person. You need somebody that has the courage and the responsibility and the willingness to honor your wishes. So that's one of the things that I see as a big regret, where people say, did I do the right thing? And they wish they, and sometimes they did not. The flip side of that one, the second one I get a lot is, I pulled the plug, or I told the doctors it was okay to let my mom go. This is one of the biggest, most common ones. And I remember sitting at an event with somebody, and this lady was so burdened. And so I asked her, did you know what your mom would want? And she said, yes, I know that my mom would want not to live in that situation, that kind of condition. So I know she would want me to say that to the doctor, but I still feel badly. And I said, if you did what she asked you to do, if you honored her wishes, if you respected what she would want, if you did all these things right, you shouldn't feel guilty. You shouldn't feel badly because, you know, you did the right thing. You still feel sad that the person died, but you didn't do anything wrong. You actually did the right thing. And you could literally see the pressure, the stress, the burden that she'd been carrying just literally come off of her shoulders. And she was so grateful. She wrote to me afterwards and said, you don't know, Vicki, how much it helped to know that I really did do the right thing. I've been carrying this every year around the holidays. I feel horrible because she died at the holidays, and I always feel like I was a bad daughter. Oh, my goodness. This stuff tortures me. And so that's why I do so much to help caregivers make good decisions now, so they don't have to be that person.
Really important. And I think your initial point, too, is really important for everybody to think about, is not to take the role on of being healthcare proxy if you're not comfortable honoring the wishes, because then you're not able to be respectful to the person. And not everybody can honor it. I know in my own situation, I was my mother's healthcare proxy, and I was really happy that we all were able ahead of time to talk before my father died, actually, so we knew what he wanted, and she was able to honor his wishes by telling them when he had this massive heart attack, don't try to revive him. He does not want to be revived, and we all felt good about that decision, and I was able, because I had that role in the family, to know she did not want to just be having no quality of life and just living out the rest of her life in a nursing home, of which the doctor kept saying, we can keep her alive with these transfusions, and I knew she was ready to die, and I was able to go behind the doctor's back and get hospice, and she died 3 days later. She was really ready to die, and she was able to die in her own bed in her assisted living apartment. And so I just also know from my own experience how important it is to be able to talk about these things, and it's so hard to do. Nobody wants to talk about death and dying and all, but it's freeing to do it. And maybe you could share a little too. I know you've taken care of six family members. And is that what led you to become a bioethicist, or what led you to this field?
I started working in this field about 12 years ago. I went back to school to get my master's in bioethics. And that was when I was 40, because I'm 52 now. But my brother tells me that I was destined for this, because when I was 21 years old, my mom had a massive stroke. And she was able to communicate some, but she was severely impaired. And she was paralyzed on one side. She was in a terrible situation, because back then we didn't have all those great tools and weight protocols to help people after a stroke. And I was her primary caregiver, and that was a hard enough role. That's why I do the work with caregivers that I do. But the reason I work in bioethics is because her doctor kept using the doctor's religion instead of my mom's religion and wishes. The doctor would impose her belief on my mom. Now, back then, I didn't even know that there were rules and laws that say we're supposed to honor patients' wishes. There's something in medicine and in the legal system called substituted judgment, where we're not supposed to substitute our opinion for someone else. We're supposed to be the substitute voice. When my mom was terribly ill, I was supposed to imagine my mom, think about what she would want, what she had told me, had she written anything down, what were her values, her culture, her religion, and I was supposed to speak with my mom's voice. Nobody told me that back then, and the doctor certainly wasn't interested in what my mom would have said. And back then, I was so tortured by this because I knew what my mom wanted. I knew that she had said, I would never want to live in this condition. We had another relative that had a similar health crisis. I knew what my mom would want, and nobody ever asked me. Nobody respected her. So she lived for a long time in a really bad condition. So I think that had always bothered me. And then eventually I found this field, and it's something that I can help people with, because it still happens. It still happens all the time. People aren't getting what they want.
It still happens, and the role of a caregiver is so hard. And I remember last time you were with us, I think we talked about helping caregivers ask for help, because it's very hard to do it, and the dilemmas of needing to take people's keys away or making a decision to put someone in a nursing home or assisted living, so many dilemmas. I'm just thinking maybe it might be nice, since the first question that came in was from Joe from Florida, to maybe ask that question since he got the ball rolling.
Sure. So, read it?
Why don't you?
This is from Joe, and he said that his mom just passed away and that he lives in Florida and she was living in Ohio, and the funeral is in Ohio on Friday. And the dilemma is he should make the trip to her funeral, but given the health challenges of his own, he may not be able to travel because it could jeopardize his health. He said that my heart wants to be there for her funeral, but my logic says I should not travel. And what a hard thing. That's one of those things that just eats you up. What is the right thing to do? What are my choices? And I can definitely see how this could have that piece of regret. I wish I'd done something different. I wish I could talk directly to him, but here's some of the things that I would ask. I would say, how was your relationship before? Did your mom know you loved her? Had you been able to see her? Had you been able to talk to her? Because going for the funeral is after the fact. It's what we do in the living, in the moments when that person is still with us. That if you have had those conversations, if you have some peace with that person, if you've expressed your love or asked for forgiveness, whatever those things are, that's enough. You don't have to go to the funeral, because the person, you've already done the work of that relationship. And another question I would ask, and it's a typical one I ask, is would that person be mad at you for not showing up? Would your mom be upset that you didn't come? Or would your mom be furious that you're jeopardizing your health by traveling there? Because that could be even more significant. But would your mom say, what are you thinking? You're in no condition to come here. You stay home and take care of yourself, right? So you always have to look at the situation from different perspectives, because it's not just what our heart wants. I am a big person. I have a person with, I have this huge empathic, compassionate, sensitive heart. I'm always trying to come from the heart, but I have to make rational decisions too. So I wanted to teach everybody one of the tools that I've developed in my new workbook, and I call it my evaluating danger tool. And this can apply to any situation where there's a danger choice involved, whether it's taking away car keys, someone shouldn't live at home. But this time the danger isn't about the senior. The danger is about the caregiver themselves. So we ask two questions, and we give a score from 0 to 10, 10 being the most, 0 being very little. So the first question is, how serious is the danger? And I would think that the fact that he's writing about this, he's saying, I have serious health conditions. How dangerous is it for you to travel? 0 to 10. So if he told me, oh, it's only a 3, okay, I would go with that. Or if he says, it's like an 8, you know, this, I have terrible illness, I can't go. So the higher the score, whatever the score is, I just write it down. So how serious is the danger? Okay, that's the first question. The second question is, what's the chance of the danger happening? Right? So a lot of times we either overreact or underreact to our worries. And that's one of the great things about this tool is it addresses, will this danger or this risk or this bad outcome actually happen, or are we just being fearful? So in this situation, the chance of him jeopardizing his health by traveling, is it just he's always worried about travel, he doesn't like travel, that would be a low score, or no, I might get a blood clot because I can't sit for a long time in a car or a plane, I'm at high risk for actually having a dangerous outcome happen. So I'm going to assume that he does have serious health issues, so how serious is the danger for him to travel? I'll give it an 8. I would never actually assign a number because it's not my body. It's not my life. I don't know his health, but we're just talking this through. And then what's the chance of it happening? Let's say it's a 6. Okay, we won't even go all the way up to a 10. So we add it together. 8 plus 6 is 14. And so here's the thing. When whatever the score is, it's going to be 0 to 20. 14 out of 20 is a pretty high score. So I would say that you probably are being realistic about making a certain choice. If it's making a decision for somebody else, I need to take away the car keys, I need to move her, because she's in danger. The higher the score, what I usually say is the quicker you need to take action. If it's really serious, we've got to take action right away. Because it's a high-risk thing, it has a high seriousness and a high chance of happening, we take action. For him, I would say if the score gets up closer and closer to 20, there's no way you can travel. There's no way that you can put yourself in that kind of risk. If your score is really low, then go ahead and travel, right? But that's a way for us to measure. And my husband always says to me, Vicki, you should tell people what the numbers are, what the right number is for a situation. And I remind him that every situation, every context is different. So I don't want to assign numbers. This is for sure when you would take such and such an action. There needs to be flexibility in this conversation, but now at least you have the two right questions to ask, and then you have a sense of how serious is it, what's the chance of it happening, when do I need to act. Now, after I would do that conversation with Joe, then I would also talk about the fact there's other options. Maybe you can't travel there. But can somebody webcam you in, like Skype you in? Mm. Can someone videotape it so you can get a copy and see it later? Can you call in and listen on the phone? Right? Can somebody hold their phone up so you can listen? Can you send something ahead of time and have people read it for you? I'm a mediator by training and by experience, and I know that a lot of times we get in either or thought process. It's either yes or no, up, down, left. We're always thinking like there's only two options in the world. if we can think that there's a third option, our brains actually relax and they can start imagining other choices, other options. So I would say, okay, yes, you cannot go. So what else can you do? Become creative. Find some other choices. Because I bet there's something that he could feel good about that would still satisfy him, but it won't put him at high risk. So that's exactly how I would have talked through that conversation with him.
Vicki, that is so helpful. Just being able to find the questions to ask and how to evaluate it. It's really helpful. And leads to Elizabeth from Minneapolis says, where can people get a copy of your new book with the kind of toolkit and resources?
Right.
Maybe this is a good time to ask that.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That's very nice of you. You can get it directly from me. I decided not to put it on Amazon. It is a workbook, so it's like an 8x10 workbook. There's articles you can print out to share with others if you're a professional or with family members. There's worksheets, there's diagrams, there's templates. I tell people it's my brain. It's exactly how I do these kinds of conversations. And so you can contact me either through my email at kind, K-I-N-D, ethics, E-T-H-S, ethics at gmail.com, or you can go through my website and just email me through that, and that's kindethics.com. So my email is kindethics@gmail.com, and my website is kindethics.com. And it comes in either a printed copy or a digital copy, just whatever you prefer.
And it's excellent. I have had the opportunity to be able to see it and use it, and I really recommend it. I think your name is so wonderful for you to be in this profession.
I know.
Because you are so kind.
I am.
I do have more questions here, and I want to honor the second one that had come in that was from Brittany. Hers were kind of comments, and what maybe can do that. And then I have a bunch more from people who've been submitting them. Maybe I can, do you want to read it? Do you want me to?
Yeah, you know, Brittany's one of four siblings, and they took care of their mom at home for a long time. Now she's in a residential care home, assisted living. But, of course, it's still challenging. And some of her comments really touch on those things that we want to do well at the beginning so we don't have regrets later. She wants to make sure that we all address and know the importance of having a will, advance directive, do not resuscitate form, et cetera. And that this is the thing that really struck me, the first thing, is that her mom has those documents. But sometimes she feels like she doesn't have enough specific details. Because a lot of these forms, it's one of my main complaints about advanced healthcare directives or living wills, is that they just are like boxes we check off. CPR, feeding tube, resuscitation. There's just all sorts of basics. And that doesn't tell you much about the person. One of the things that I developed that's in the workbook, but I also have a 80-minute DVD that actually teaches you all of these tools, a DVD regarding end-of-life discussions. One of the things that I've done is I've created a list of questions that are what I call quality-of-life questions, things that would describe you in more detail and more personally. A form just doesn't sound like you. I want you to use your basic advanced directive form, whatever that is in your state, and then answer some of these questions. Let me give you a few of them. It's something that I've done, and I'm glad to share my own advanced directive with everybody. I can either send it to you directly, or I can send it to Dory to distribute. I will go ahead and send that afterwards. So
If you send it to me, we can send it out with the recording.
Wonderful. I'll definitely do that. So here's the thing. When I'm sitting there being a bioethicist trying to resolve a conflict in the hospital and the doctors are upset and the family's upset and the patient is too sick to speak for him or herself, a lot of times they have the advanced directive and it's still not helping because it sounds like everybody else's form. It's just boxes. So here are three of the questions I would tell people that you need to write a paragraph about, have a conversation about, just like Dory had conversations. So she's not filled with regret and guilt and grief. She misses her, but she doesn't feel badly. There's a list of 9 questions. You don't have to use them all. Here's the 3 most important. Here's the first one. What is important to me, or what makes my life worth living? Right? I want that doctor, the nurses, even your family from out of town that has lost touch with you. I want people to know what brings you joy, what makes your life worth living, right? Because we're all different. Some people, it's being able to knit, or I love to go out in nature, or it's the sound of my grandkids giggling. And there it is, write a couple sentences. Don't write pages and pages. The doctor doesn't want to read that. But write a little mini paragraph about who you are and what matters to you. Because I need to know, what is your high-level goal? When the healthcare choices are being made, what would be a great outcome bringing you back to that level? The next question is, what conditions would I find horrible to live with long-term? Or sometimes I ask it, what would be a fate worse than death? And Dory, do you have something that would be a fate worse than death?
For me, it's really being in a kind of vegetative state of not having any quality of life, not being able to be with, deal with people who I love. I really don't want to be a burden on people, and I really don't want to live without any quality of life. I think I'm influenced by my mom, because, you know, we had talked about that. And it's like not being able to do any of the things that matter and being in my own little sort of cocoon. I don't want to live that way.
So here's a couple things. I don't know if you've added any of that kind of language mm-hmm. to your own advanced directive. I would encourage you to. Most people, after mm-hmm. they hear me, they go and make some modifications.
Yeah.
So here's a couple things that if you wrote down what you just said, some of it was awesome, mm-hmm. that you love the connection mm-hmm. with people, right? That you want to do what matters. But that's the problem. I don't know you as the medical mm-hmm. professional. I don't know what matters. So when mm-hmm. you use a descriptive term, I want dignity, I want mm-hmm. no suffering, whatever it is, give me mm-hmm. an example of it. Because when mm-hmm. you kept saying quality of life, but I will tell you, I've heard everything from people. I've heard people say, I don't care if I'm laying there drooling, can't recognize my loved ones. My life is still worth living because I'm profoundly religious and it's God's will. And I'm totally so happy when they explain that to me, so I know how to respect their vision of their life. Another person would be, no, if I can't dance and play and run and leap for joy, no, I don't want to live. But you see how different the specifics make the decision? So that's what we all need to do is write down. That's why that first question is, what is important to you? What makes your life worth living? Tell me about the good stuff. Now, when you said what would be a fate worse than death or a horrible condition, you said you wouldn't want to be vegetative. Now, I would caution you about using that word, because in medicine, we use the word persistent vegetative state, and we use it because of the law. Persistent means we're very certain you're not coming back out of this. And the law likes us to be specific, you know for sure. But health and life is messy. So if you really meant, I wouldn't want to lay there and not recognize my loved ones. I wouldn't want to be locked in and not be able to communicate. I wouldn't want... Again, I wouldn't use a medical term like vegetative state, because what if you're in a coma? What if you're minimally conscious? Mm. What if there's all sorts of other degrees and words for that kind of condition? So you're using a medical term in a way that you may not know what that specifically means, but we take you literally. And so I
really helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would tell you, describe what would be the losses of laying there. What could you not do? Why would that be a fate worse than death? Again, like for me, you'll see it in my directive. I've listed some criteria. And then the last question I ask, and this comes from palliative care, is what would be an acceptable level of better? If I couldn't get you back to being able to knit and enjoying your grandkids, what would be acceptable? Now, that's the fancy way to ask it. The way I usually ask it is, you wouldn't like it, but you'd be willing to live with it. I wouldn't like to be in a wheelchair, but I could live with it. I wouldn't like to lose my hearing, but I could live with it. I wouldn't like to have some dementia, but as long as it's not really bad dementia, I could live with it. Right? And because it has to be not just physical, it has to be cognitive too, because that's when you can't speak for yourself. Be descriptive. What would be, yeah, I would hate that. Okay. Like the person that the knitting is something that actually got brought up in one of these conversations with someone when I was consulting with her. She said, oh, I love to knit. It's so important to me. It makes my life worth living. I said, if you couldn't knit, would that mean that we should let you go? She said, oh, no, that's not what I meant. It's important to me, but it's not the end all, right? She said to me, if I can still connect with people, if I can still receive love and give love, those were the things, and be cognizant of it. Even if I can't communicate, but someone could hold my hand and I could know it, if somebody could be caring, that's the richness of having this conversation. And because I don't know you, I'm a medical professional, I don't know you, you've just shown up in my hospital, and I've got your crazy relatives all yelling at me, telling me different things. I want to hear it in your voice. I want to hear directly from you what it is you want, what you would hate, and what you could live with.
That is really excellent. It's also helped me realize part of what enabled my mom to say what she did, and for my brother and I to really agree, is my father was dying at the time, and it was clear he didn't want the procedures that were going to happen, but he was going to do it. But then there was a malfunction in the oxygen equipment, and he had this massive heart attack, and he really didn't want to live more compromised. And so it was just able to be really clear. But it helped. What you're saying is so important, that the specifics of it are really important. I am going to go back and rewrite. I know I've said these different things to my husband, but it's got to be written down. And what you're saying is it's got to be there for the doctor.
And it has to be
that
written
is so
down.
Helpful.
Because what if, heaven forbid, something happens and you and your husband are in a car accident and you're both ill? And he's not the one speaking for you, because our spouses, right, our partners know us pretty well. Hopefully they'll respect our wishes, but if they won't, pick somebody else. But you got to write it down, because people in these moments, families show up out of the woodwork. I'm just working on a case right now where relatives that haven't seen this person in 40 years have shown up and who are trying to take over the health decisions, the finances. Basically, I think they're elder abusers coming in trying to suck out the resources, and there's lawyers involved. But somebody should have written down, these people should be allowed to visit me. Those people, don't let them in the room, because they didn't like these people. That's why they hadn't spoken. You can write that kind of stuff in your directive. There's one other question that she asked, or a frustration that she's experienced when she was taking care of her mom, is that she has these documents, and Brittany found out that sometimes the doctors either don't know they exist, even though they have a copy, or they don't respect them, they don't follow them. Just a couple quick answers to those issues. One is, every time you get a new doctor on board, or like a new consultant comes in, or a new nurse, because they rotate through the shift, if you're there, say to them, did you know that my mom has an advanced directive? Have you read it? Do you know her wishes? This is important. Hold the professionals accountable to know that, yes, the documents exist and that people are reading it. Because I hear, this is one of those regrets people have. My mom had a do not resuscitate, and the doctors resuscitated her against her will because they didn't ever look in the chart. So here's the thing. If a doctor does something against the patient's stated wishes, if it's all vague, like we don't know the wishes, we haven't had conversations, that's a lot harder. But if it is specially written down, and then the doctor goes against what she wrote down in her directive or her post or whatever you have in your state, it's actually assault and battery. It is a crime, because no means no. Supreme Court of the United States says that we have the right to say no to any medical treatment, a small treatment, a big treatment, anything that we say, no, I don't want that IV. No, I don't want to be on a ventilator. No, I won't do that. I don't want that. If we wrote it down, it needs to be implemented. And so here's what I'll say to a doctor who's telling me that they're going to go against the advance directive. I'll graciously, because I don't need to cause more trouble, because I'm going to make a point, I'll say to the doctor, doctor, if she said no, then we have to honor it by law. If not, it's assault and battery. And then I'll sit there and I'll ponder for a moment and I'll go, oh dear, that's a crime. Oh dear, that's not just a crime. That will need a criminal lawyer when you're taken to court. It's not a civil malpractice action. It's a criminal action and your, oh, I don't know if you know this, doctor, your malpractice carrier won't cover it because they only do malpractice. They're not criminal. You'll be responsible for all the fees. And then I'll stop and I'll say, but of course it's your decision. It is. They are the doctor. I can't make them behave. I can report them if they're doing criminal things, and I will, and I have. Mm-hmm. But the reality, no means no. So we do have to be, we have to feel like we have some strength. If you're coming up against doctors who say, I'm just going to do with this for a while to see if she'll get better, but you're like, no, she said no. She didn't even want it for a while. She didn't want this. No means no. And so feel confident, call the bioethics committee, call the legal department of the hospital, take a stand because your loved one can't protect themselves. They're unconscious or too sick. You've got to be a good, strong advocate.
Excellent advice. Excellent. Yeah.
So those are the main concerns.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. There's a number of other questions here, so let me keep going so Elizabeth from Minneapolis asks, what are the biggest challenges in the area that you see between young married spouses? She doesn't elaborate. It could be young married spouses in terms of their parents, or it could be young married spouses in terms of caregiving of each other.
If she wants to type something else, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I'm just going to tell you about an organization that I'm a part of. It's called the Well Spouse Association, because a lot of times the person can be ill. It's spouses, significant others, partners, whether somebody's coming back from the war at age 23 with a brain injury, or someone's had multiple sclerosis for 50 years, any age, any disease, but that relationship is very different. Taking care of an aging parent is very different from taking care of our life partner because the losses are different, the roles are different. The Well Spouse Association is a national organization. They have an online chat room, which is awesome because at 2 a.m. when you're up, you've just gotten up to take care of the person, your wife, you can get online and say, oh, she's driving me crazy. And someone else is on the line also saying, me too, but this is how I manage this. This is how I help. It's basically this amazing support group where they have knowledge and support and care for each other. They have retreats. They have phone-in support groups. They have mentoring. It's an amazing organization that I've recommended to so many people because they get it. We know that if you are a spousal caregiver and you don't, and your friends aren't at that age where they're doing it, they look at you like, I don't relate. I'm worried about my kids. And it's like, no, I'm worried about my husband. So it's a great resource. The reality is it always comes down to communication. And that's why, Dori, I love your book, the Couples Retirement Puzzle, the 10 conversations. You and I exchanged books back at the Positive Aging Conference.
Yeah.
And I didn't need it then. You know how life, I'm not quite there yet, but my husband is older. And about a year ago, we started going through your book. And it has helped so much because
so good to hear.
He is getting ready because you and I understand that it's not about knowing the answers. It's about knowing the right question. In bioethics, I don't know the answers. I don't know your life, but I know the questions to ask to get you to your answers.
That is really important, and that's where your book, I think, is so helpful, and particularly the new one with the tools. So let me keep going with some of these questions, because we have a combination of some people asking in terms of their parents and some in terms of spouse. So it fits right into what you were saying. So Frank from Wakefield, from Massachusetts, says, my 90-year-old mother-in-law passed away a year ago. She was the primary caregiver for my 95-year-old father-in-law, who has dementia. He has no short-term memory and very little long-term memory. My wife, sister-in-law, and I are sharing caregiver responsibilities, and he's still living at home. After he came home from the funeral, he kept asking, where's mommy? Each time we told him she had passed, it was as if it was the first time he heard the news, and he would get very upset. After 5 torturous days of this, I called the Alzheimer's hotline, and they advised that we tell him a, quote, clinical fib, and just say she's upstairs sleeping. This worked. A year later, we're still telling him the same thing. Sometimes my wife feels guilty because she feels she's lying to his face. Any advice on how to ease her guilt feelings?
Oh, I love this question. This is one I get. This is the answer that you were given from the Alzheimer's Association is was the right answer. And so here's why it's the right answer. In general, I'm an ethicist. I don't believe in telling lies, right? Truthfulness is very important professionally and personally. But the rules change when somebody has dementia. And this is what you can explain to her. When somebody has a cognitive impairment and cannot process the information, right? If you tell me that somebody has died, I'm going to grieve. I might even be in denial. You'll have to tell me again. But eventually, I can come to terms with it because my brain can help me get there. When someone is impaired, they don't have that tool. So now all you're doing is causing harm and grief. And you're not being caring, because that's an important ethical rule, too, being caring and compassionate and loving and not causing harm. That's one of the ones we have in healthcare, do no harm. Every time you would tell someone, she's dead, don't you remember? That would cause terrible harm. So when the person lacks the ability to process the information, it is kindness, it is caring, it is fine to say something like, oh, she's at the market. Oh, she's upstairs. Oh, she's at the doctor's. You can give it variety, because otherwise all you're doing is making things worse. One of my rules when it comes to any kind of cognitive impairment is we should do all the things that bring the person more comfort, joy, peace, happiness, all the good stuff, right? So we increase their life in all the ways we can that improves it, whether it's having them have some ice cream if that makes them happy, or not making, helping them go out for an outing, whatever it is with your person, I don't know your person, bring more joy, more happiness, more comfort. And then on the other side, stop doing things that increase their pain, their suffering, their anxiety, their grief, their stress. Stop doing that. Decrease those. Don't do the things that irritate them. Don't do the things that make them feel worse. They cannot cope. It's like trying to tell a one-year-old to pull it together. What are you thinking? They cannot just get it together. They can't suck it up. They're vulnerable. So do things that increase their joy and comfort. Decrease. Stop doing things that make them feel worse. Sad, fearful, pain, and that could be emotional or physical pain. That's my rule. And so that's how I look at that one. I should really put that one in my workbook. I'll have to do that one.
Yeah, that's a really good one, because I think that guilt issue, which comes up in so many ways, and I think your comment about the goal is to bring comfort, joy, peace, and happiness and not inflict more pain.
Doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You can take it from me. I'm an ethicist. I always think that's funny what people believe, does it?
All right, now is a question about a spouse. So Judy from Boston, what tools can you suggest for a family deciding when enough is enough? My husband's been diagnosed with brain cancer. How many surgeries and clinical trials should a family go through to keep him with us? He is all about quality of life, and we will support that.
So every we can totally do this. Okay, so number one, the rule is that all his own path through life has to be from his perspective. It's not that the rest of you aren't being affected, but he's the one that is experiencing the consequences of this decision. Every time he goes through a treatment or something that comes with some suffering, some burden, feeling worse, it's hard for us to watch, but he's living it. So the first rule is substituted judgment. We honor what he would say is the right thing to do. And we look at it from not just a medical point of view, we look at it from a burden point of view. How much burden is he willing to accept? And the amount of burden we're willing to accept is usually determined by how much benefit we're willing to work towards. So if you think about it in two categories, what's the burden? How much suffering are we talking about? And what are we getting for that suffering? So if he can still be at family events, read a book, whatever is important to him, right? What is important to him? Can those treatments provide him the opportunity to do what's important to him, what's meaningful, what's worthwhile? Because if all it does, it gets him stuff that isn't worthwhile, that all he's doing is existing, and for him, that's not enough, then it's okay to change the path and make sure he has hospice and palliative care and all the good support and love and people telling him he's loved and having family visit, whatever it is. The medicine choices always have to be in the context of the person's life that's experiencing them. The two questions I ask now are, what will this treatment do for the patient? What good will come out of it? And what will this treatment do to the patient? What are we doing to his life, his quality, so many times patients will say to me, Vicki, this is horrible. I don't want this, but the doctors won't let me stop. Wait a minute. It's none of the doctor's business when to start and stop because you're the one living this life. The doctor goes home to his or her family. You're the one experiencing this. So I would say it might be time, or if you know him because he can't communicate, think about what's the goal. Can this medical treatment get you to the goal, or is it only getting you to something that's not worth it? And then we don't give up. That's not the word. We change course. We have a new path. Then we advocate to make sure he gets all the good love and support and care that he needs. So however many days, weeks, or months he has, those are good days.
Very important. And it really actually ties into this next question, too, that Kenneth from Florida is asking. So it's a parent again rather than the spouse, but I think it has to do with that shift potentially to palliative care and hospice. So he says, my mom's 91 years young, has had a full, vibrant life, and still has a great attitude. She was recently diagnosed with congestive heart failure and has had 2 hospitalizations plus 3 weeks in rehab over the last 2 months. She's lived happily in an assisted living facility for the last 3 years with a great deal of independence and high functioning and is back there now. She's tired much of the time, as someone would be who has about 20% of her heart capacity, as per the cardiologist's report. I have a feeling there will be more hospitalizations, and I know she doesn't want that. However, I have not reached the hospice conversation with her because she's in denial of the seriousness of her condition. Her overzealous doctor has told her repeatedly that she'll probably live to 100, and she sees him as the mighty and powerful as God. I feel like she would want to stay home for the duration of her life. I'm fearful of her backlash in talking about the hospice conversation. Any feedback, input, guidance, directions, and her coaching is gladly welcome.
Thank you. Sweet. Thank you for caring so much. All of you are just amazing. So here's the thing. You and I know that the doctor is more scared than you are of having this conversation. The reason doctors lie to patients and say, you're going to live to 100. My dad's doctor did the same thing. It's like, you're going to live. No, he isn't. He's failing. His heart is dying because he had congestive heart failure too. So unfortunately, doctors they almost betray their patients because they don't tell the truth. And there's reasons for it. Sometimes they care so much that they don't want to give bad news. They don't want to hurt that person, but it's wrong. They're really supposed to talk about it. Here's my approach. Instead of talking about it like hospice, like time for the actual decision, you need to talk about the values. When you can understand more the values and the goals and what's meaningful, the decisions become easy. Making a decision about hospice all by itself is hard to do, but versus saying, what kind of comfort do you want? What makes your life worth living? Those same questions that I'm going to send to Dori, that I've mentioned 3 of the 9 for you, those will help you a lot because that can give you a framework to say, let's talk about this. What is important to you? When you approach the conversation, don't talk about it about dying. Talk about how much you want to do right by her. You want to make sure she's respected. If she gets sick next time, you want to make sure you're saying the right things to the doctors. Couch it that way. Don't bring up dying. Talk about what kind of conditions, what are her preferences. And then you can fit in the other decisions. So another thing that people do is they talk about it with their parents saying, this is a gift you can give me, Mom. You can give me this gift of knowing what to do. I listened to this lady, and she said, so many people have regrets that they live with for years, and I don't want to have those, Mom. So would you be willing to talk to me about this? Because if she loves you, that might motivate her to talk about it. Another thing you can say is, as a parent, it's your responsibility to teach me how to be brave in these moments and how to know what's right. You can go about this whatever way that makes sense for your relationship. But most seniors do actually want to talk about this, especially our oldest seniors, because they know it's approaching. She knows she wants it to be true that she's going to live a long time. But as each thing disappears for her, like each ability, each quality of life thing, there's going to get a point where it's too much. There's a wonderful video that, you might want to get from Amazon. I think it's $25. It's called Consider the Conversation, or you can get it online at considertheconversation.org. Get part one. There's 2 parts, but you need part one. And it's this wonderful video about having these meaningful conversations. And in it, a physician who has ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, he talks about, here are the 100 things that make my life worth living. And then he decides how many of those he can lose before life is not worth it. And that's just one approach. You could have her write down what's the 20 things that bring you joy, and how, and as different things get taken away, how many can you lose before you say enough? So that's another approach. I really love that video because people will talk after they watch it.
Yeah.
You could even donate it to the assisted living or share it with everyone in your faith community. There's people that host events in their community and watch this and then have people come in and talk about it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful video. I recommend it. I use it for my class. I teach a gerontology course, and it's a fabulous video. I didn't know there was a part two, so I'm going to have to check that out. But I've seen the part one. I do want to honor the time. I know that it's getting to be 1, and some people have to leave. You had said you have a little bit more flexibility.
Yeah, answer more questions.
Okay.
But not a problem.
There are a couple more, so I want to keep on. Kenneth from Florida has 1 more question. He says, and then there's another question too. I'm the primary caretaker and decision making for my 91-year young mom. My older brother lives in Europe and is minimally involved. I feel like he doesn't care and offers very little support to me and seldom contacts my mom. How do I stop myself from getting angry and resentful toward him? How do I love him for who he is and how he is?
Boy, that's a loaded question. Much bigger than we can solve here. But one thing I will tell you is if he is not interfering and sabotaging and causing trouble, that's good. Leave him over there in Europe. Because too often these people fly in at the last minute and cause chaos because they're so guilty about not being there. They come in and say, keep her alive against her will because I've got to have a relationship with her and I've got to solve all my mom issues. Sometimes having somebody that's far away is a blessing. So that's one side of it. The reality is everybody has to live their life the way they think is they need to. He's going to have regret. This is one of the things where I try to open up these conversations because you're not going to have the regret. You, Kenneth, you've actually been there for her. You've done all this. You've enjoyed the richness and the challenges of caregiving, both sides of it. You're going to have a lot of peace because at the end of your life, you're going to look back and say, I was a good son. He's not going to have that peace. For me, I cannot fix other people. I cannot change them. I can wish them well. He's probably always been like this. We can't change who people are. If you can inspire him, that's the what you can't make people, but you can try to inspire him. Maybe send him a copy of this video or send him, if you find a book about love that you want to send him, you can try. We can always still keep reaching out. But if in the reaching out, all it does is cause us pain because that person can't love us, can't love back. I think sometimes it's right to let those people go or at least let them live at a distance from us because, again, for our own lives, we're not supposed to do things that keep increasing our pain and agony and sadness. We're supposed to live with joy, right? So if he's not that person for you and your mom, wish him well. Let him have his own journey. Focus on what you do have. If you need to be mad at him, be mad at him. But don't let that madness take away the joy that you can have in the rest of your life.
I think that's very powerful and important advice. It reminds me of this very old film, but one of my favorites. I don't know if you've seen it, Vicki, but I recommend it. It's called I Never Sang for My Father.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. Yeah, I've heard of it.
It's very powerful. It starts with the quote, people die, but relationships live on forever or live on inside forever. And it so ties into what you're saying, that the more that you can deal with whomever it is that you love or are ambivalent about, the more you can deal while they're alive, then there are less regrets. Otherwise, life can be filled with just ongoing regrets. It's an old movie, but I recommend it. Mary from Newburgh says, it's hard for me to maintain contact with my elderly neighbor with dementia because of her endless requests for my time. I don't want to ignore her, but how can I help her without feeling overwhelmed by her demands on my time?
Yeah, this is when it's very hard as loving and caring people to not get sucked in, because I really struggle with this. It's hard to have boundaries. Hopefully you're not trying to take care of her, someone with dementia, all by yourself. If she has a lot of dementia, she shouldn't be living alone. You probably need to reach out to other people to get a team of people in there, because you cannot do it alone. And you're not supposed to, none of us. Even if it's our family member, we're not supposed to do all this alone. It's too big of a job. One is get a team of people. Reach out to your local resources because you can't do this alone. Secondly, what you're saying is I feel guilty because I think I'm not doing enough, or I feel guilty when I say no. So here's the thing. The word guilt is for when you actually are doing something wrong. So I would ask you, Mary, to ask yourself, when I set up a boundary. When I say I can only help you for an hour today, I can only do this one thing this week. When you say no, are you actually doing something wrong or do you just feel badly? By setting up that boundary, are you really doing something wrong or do you just feel badly? If you're doing something wrong, and this is a formula, I'm doing a conversation formula. If what you're doing is actually wrong for any of us, we need to correct that. But if all it is you feel badly, then that's not guilt. You're calling it guilt because it still feels badly in your gut, right? We feel like, oh, I wish it were different. I regret. I wish I were superhuman. I could do more for everybody. That's that feeling. But guilt is when we're doing wrong. So I can't necessarily have people not feel badly that you can't do more, that you have to set up healthy boundaries. You're still going to feel badly, but please don't call it guilt. Don't feel wrong for doing it, because you're not doing anything wrong. You're actually showing up for a neighbor. You're helping out somebody that doesn't have someone else. You're doing right. So maybe if you can let go of blaming yourself or feeling wrong about that, you can just say to yourself, I'm doing the right thing. I wish I could do more, but I can't, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with having I don't need to feel badly. So I really think we must put up caregiving rules for ourselves, because here's why. If as family caregivers and even as professionals, if we get overwhelmed by all we're doing for other people, we die sooner. Studies have come out saying that if you are a full-time type of caregiver, not even hands-on full-time, but doing caregiving for a long time, you die 8 to 10 years sooner than other people your same age. Because literally our DNA is changing. Our DNA changes. Our healthy, we have telomeres that kind of hold our DNA together. They're kind of like the ends of our DNA, and they start shrinking. They start aging faster because of the stress and the burden and the exhaustion and not taking care of ourselves. So we are actually, it's not just about feeling badly or not doing enough. We are actually affecting our health, where we are going to change our destiny in a substantial way because we're not taking care of ourselves. So when people say you should do more, or you say that to yourself, you know what? You should do more to take care of yourself. You should do more positive aging activities. They know that you can stretch your DNA by doing the positive aging things, eating better, exercising, having that community of support, feeling connected to your community. All the things that people teach in positive aging help stretch our DNA and our telomeres and help prevent some of the damage that caregiving gives us. That's what you should be doing. So I would encourage you not to feel badly about it. Do what you can, and then do for yourself.
Very sage advice. Hard sometimes for people to hear because it's so easy to feel like we don't do enough. But what I'm hearing you say is recognize what you are doing and take care of yourself.
Yeah,
that's
celebrate
really
what you are doing.
Yeah.
In my workbook, I have a whole section on caregiving, taking care of ourselves, because that's something I didn't put in my first book. And I destroyed myself. I literally destroyed myself being a caregiver, and I don't do that now. I'm much better at taking care of myself and still being a caregiver. But boy, it was a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah. So maybe that's one of the really important mistakes that you're sharing of learning. That's key, of taking care of yourself. Vicki, this has been so rich and wonderful. So just a couple, just in terms of pulling it together, the questions that people asked have been wonderful. And any other advice that you have when somebody is that one loves is dying, advice so that one doesn't have regret?
I think you have to actually ask yourself that question. What do I need to do so I don't have regret? Do I need to make sure I spend some more time? Do I need to ask for forgiveness? Do I need to send money because I can't be there, but I want to support my siblings that are taking care of her? Right? Because sometimes it's not really about us. It's about caring for the people that are surrounding that person. There's a lot of things people tell me they want to do. My husband and I are getting to that age, as everybody knows, where people start dying a lot. And my husband has instituted this new rule for his life where after he sees a friend, because he's had a number of people just drop dead, and he didn't get to say his I love yous and I you're important to me. So now when he hugs people goodbye, he says, I love and appreciate, and I appreciate you. And it was really startling at first because a bunch of guys came over to play cards or something, and at the end he hugs each of them and says, I love and appreciate you. And they're like, what? And he explains that he needs to do this. He doesn't want anyone else to not know how much he cares. And now when those same guys come over, especially this one man, he starts it. He'll grab everyone and go, I love and I appreciate you. And it's just been beautiful to watch how certain people have embraced that, and now they're doing it. We're seeing a lot of people give that back to us. We do that because it's what we need to do to have peace in our lives. I've always done things like that because I'm in hospice, and I know that you've got to say stuff now because you don't know if you get tomorrow. But to watch my husband grow his whole circle of friends has been really incredible. So tell people I love and I appreciate you, or whatever you need to say, because and say it today.
That's wonderful advice. Wonderful. So Mary wrote back and said, thank you for helping me see the difference about guilt. I like the boundary setting and will work on setting up a team of others to join in on her life too. I appreciate your response.
Thank you, Mary. That makes me feel good.
One last question, then any final takeaways that are things you'd like to say. But so it relates to a little bit of what we started with here. But so what do you tell people so they can find peace when they can't change the past?
I think it's people always say forgiveness, and I struggle with forgiveness. I'm not always the most forgiving person of others. As an ethicist, I have high standards, but I think we cannot keep carrying things forward, right? Because they're polluting our present. If we're still feeling badly that I made this decision in the past or I didn't do right here, I would go back to those same rules of own up, say you're sorry, and make it right. So own up, even if it's just to yourself, because you can't fix something in the past. You know what? I had a part of this. This is what I could have done differently. Say you're sorry if you can. And then if you can fix it, great. If you can find a way to solve it. And then don't make that mistake again. I think life is about not making the same mistakes over and over again. We make new ones, but we don't need to make the same ones. So learn the lessons. Because all I can have is that I did the best I could. I cleaned up the mess as I went along. I tried really hard. I think we have to do our best in the moment, but don't carry your regrets forward with you, because I don't think that helps. Carry the memories and the knowledge that you gained of it, that you won't do those things again, but let them go. They're not serving you anymore. Learn the lesson, move on.
I think that's good advice. And sometimes what I have found with some of my clients, and even with myself at different points, that sometimes writing a letter to the person, even if they're not here any longer, is a way of being able to own and also forgive yourself for being human and doing the best you can, but not necessarily doing what now with hindsight you wished that you had done.
Yeah. And most of the time when people say they feel badly about the past, they actually did something right. It comes back to that formula where you actually did the right thing. It was hard. It was painful. You still have grief because the situation was sad. But most of the time, we did the right thing. It's just hard to live with knowing we had to make hard choices. So if you did the right thing, let it go.
Excellent. This has just been wonderful. And I must say, I both love and appreciate you and everything that you do and that you give. And I think this has just been so rich for everybody. Any final just takeaways you'd like people to take away from this?
Oh, you know what? I am so appreciative because this is my life's work, and getting to do that and to help people. And I know people listen to you, Dori, and that you have a huge impact. And so for me, I'm full of gratitude, and I'm so grateful that I can make a difference, because I know that goodness spreads. Everyone takes something and then teaches the next person, and so it just fills me up. When I get to the end of my life, I'm going to know that I mattered and that I made a difference, and that's what we all want, is to know that we made a difference.
Right.
So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, and you certainly have made a difference, and I think touched many people's lives. Do you want to just once more give your contact information so people
sure.
have it?
My website is kindethics.com, and my email is kindethics@gmail.com, and feel free to reach out.
Great. Thank you, Vicki, and thank you, everybody, for being part of the call and your very powerful and really wonderful questions. So take care. Bye.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.